Yeah, we're going to be jumping in. We're going to be starting the wisdom literature today, which I'm excited to dive into. So we covered Psalms last week, the Ruth the week before. And so the next 3 weeks, we're going to be covering the wisdom literature. And that's just kind of how a category that we kind of put on some of these books. Really, it's just kind of the next several books in the order of our discussion here. And so the wisdom literature, generally speaking, covers Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, and Lamentations. Lamentations gets put next to Jeremiah at the end of Jeremiah, both because likely Jeremiah wrote it, and also it kind of follows right on. You know, Jeremiah ends with the fall of Jerusalem, and then Lamentations is about the siege and fall of Jerusalem. So that's kind of why it's a little bit not quite packed in with the other books, but. So today we're going to cover Proverbs, Song of Solomon. We're going to do a little bit of an overview, cover Proverbs, Song of Solomon, and then try to touch on Lamentations. This will be, again, very high level, so we'll just kind of get cruising a little bit. For those of you who are keeping score at home, the date on the handout is wrong, just so you know. It is not the 7th. You are correct. It is the 14th, in case you were confused. I just didn't change that before I printed it, and I had 50 copies, and I wasn't going to print 50 more copies to get the date right. You know what day it is. Anyways, so the interesting thing about the wisdom literature is that these books tend to help us think about kind of the perennial issues of life in a good but fallen world, right? So these books help us to hold on to both of these truths, and these are going to be your first two blanks, that the world is good, is created by God for his glory and our good, and yet the world is fallen. The world is fallen, marred by sin, both our own and those around us, and even just the corruption of creation, and is touched by curse and death. So that's kind of the major theme of all five of these books. Basically, how do you live in such a world? How do you live in a good but fallen world? So these books help us to understand how to relate, this is your next blank, norms and exceptions. These books help us to understand and how to relate norms and exceptions. So sometimes it's we kind of only gravitate towards thinking about the norms, right? This is how life should go. This is kind of the general principles. If I do this, this will happen. If I do this, that will happen. And sometimes we kind of only live in that headspace, and we don't make room for exceptions. Well, what about sometimes the times where those general rules don't play out that way? On the other hand, some people tend to gravitate towards kind of only living in the exceptions, right? Whenever you want to talk about kind of any issue, it's always, well, let's run right to the really hard cases, right to the really exceptional things, and just talk about kind of the exceptions. Right. And it's not just a love for controversy. We just kind of want to get into what about the interesting things. So what's going to be helpful about the wisdom literature is that it's going to give us a hearty place for the norms. This is kind of the normative principles for how life under God's rule in a fallen world operates, while helping us appreciate the exceptions. While helping us appreciate the sometimes it doesn't quite work out that way. So Proverbs, this is your next blank. This is going to cover your norms. This is kind of the core normative book of the wisdom literature. This is what happens to the godly. This is what happens to the faithful. If you're diligent, things will go well for you. If you're lazy, you will not do well in the world. These are the norms. But then Job, for instance, the rest of them really are exceptions. Well, I probably wouldn't say that. These two, Job and Ecclesiastes, for sure, are the exceptions. Job is about exception. That's the blank. Sometimes things just go bad for no sin and no fault of your own. The interesting thing about Job is it's just horrible story of how things just went really bad for Job. And the book is just at pains to reiterate, this isn't because of anything Job did. This isn't because of Job's sin. And so it just helps us to at least see, hey, sometimes it doesn't play out like we expect it to. And Ecclesiastes is an interesting exception as well. Sometimes things go extremely well and you still find yourself unhappy. Right? Proverbs holds out this picture of the blessed life of, you know, honor the Lord, walk uprightly, work hard, be faithful. You'll live a good and godly life and you'll be blessed. And Ecclesiastes says, sometimes things go really, really well for you and you still have this empty gnawing in your heart. What do we do with that? Jason Deroshi, one of my professors, has this line in his lecture notes that was really helpful, just describing the wisdom literature. So he says, the life of wisdom declared in Proverbs is not an easy path, and the truths of world order laid out in Proverbs do not always find immediate fulfillment. As such, Job and Ecclesiastes provide a balanced call to continue to fear and follow God and to turn from evil even when life is filled with suffering and enigma. Enigma. Wise living for humans always means dependence on a God who is not controlled, but who is always in control. I said that was really helpful. There is just suffering that doesn't always follow an if-then pattern, and there is just enigma where sometimes we just don't know what's going on. Okay, quick overview. Proverbs is norms, again, wisdom for living a godly life. Job, fearing the Lord when things go really bad. Ecclesiastes, fearing the Lord when everything goes your way. Godly, bad, everything. Right. Again, we just want to note the danger on both ends, interestingly. So Proverbs 30, verses 7 through 9. Again, so Proverbs is aware of the exceptions. It's not like Proverbs is just kind of simplistically unaware there are exceptions. Proverbs 30, verses 7 through 9 is really interesting. It says, two things I ask of you, deny them not to me before I die. Remove far from me falsehood and lying. And this is interesting. Give me neither poverty, when things are really bad, nor riches, things are really well. Feed me with the food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. So Proverbs is saying we need help. We need help to know how to live godly ways. Our flesh is not our friend and are not our ally. When things go really well, there are going to be certain temptations that we need to be aware of to live a good and godly life, fearing the Lord. And then when things are really poorly, there are certain temptations that we need to be aware of in order to live a good and godly life. And so that's what the wisdom literature is going to try to help us to do, to see, here are the norms. This is where you're going to live most of the time for most of the people, most of your lives. And yet you need to be aware of the exceptions and the dangers and the pitfalls that come with those. Then you say the Song of Solomon. It's about marriage, but it's an example of how to fear the Lord in good times. How to fear the Lord in the good things of life. And then Lamentations, about the fall of Jerusalem. And this is an example of how to fear the Lord under his sharp discipline when things go poorly. And importantly, when things go poorly as a result of my sin. Lamentations, again, is at pains, I'll get into this in a bit, is at pains to say, this is because of Jerusalem's sin that Jerusalem was destroyed. So sometimes we do need to recognize, how do I live a good and godly life when I'm feeling the consequences of my own sin? Okay, wisdom literature and human mastery. That's your next blank. Mastery in the world. Stephen Dempster, I've quoted him throughout this series quite a bit, says this, the books that follow the wisdom literature fall into the category of wisdom literature, okay, he says that, which develops the theme of human mastery of the world. Wisdom signifies the mastery of a skill in a particular domain. He goes on to kind of explain different ways that the word wisdom is used in the Old Testament, used for everything from making clothing for priests, for making the tabernacle, for just various skills, for sailing, for metallurgy, and for combat. So kind of the Old Testament picture of what wisdom is this skill and mastery and kind of excellence in a certain domain. Dempster goes on, the wisdom books present wisdom not in terms of a specific skill, but for life itself. Consequently, Solomon in part embodies what it means to fulfill the call to be human in Genesis 1, 27 to 28, namely to rule the creation and to exercise dominion over it. Wisdom literature specifically deals with this concern for legitimate mastery and control of creation. Okay, so the picture of the wise life that these books paint brings together the righteous life, how to be godly, Proverbs 3, verse 7, be not wise in your own eyes, fear the Lord, turn away from evil. One of the main thrusts of the wisdom literature is how to live a righteous life. Point two, the satisfying life, how to be happy, how to be satisfied in the life that God has given you, Proverbs 15, 16 through 17. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble with it. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fattened ox and hatred with it. So part of what the wisdom literature is trying to do is to help you see, you want happiness in life? This here is the path, not just kind of infinite wealth, infinite status. You want the happy life. There's actually a way that God has made for you to live that. Righteous life, satisfying life. And then the dominion life. Dominion life. How to actually impact the world around you for good. God has put us here to exercise dominion over this creation for his glory and the good of one another. Proverbs 29:2, when the righteous increase, the people rejoice, but when the wicked rule, the people groan. Proverbs 21:5, the plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, kind of dominion in your own life. The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. You want to exercise good and godly dominion over the spheres that God has given you in your own life? Be diligent. Don't be hasty. All of this righteousness, satisfaction, and dominion is founded on what Solomon calls the fear of the Lord. Proverbs 9:10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is insight. Okay, let's jump into Proverbs, unpack that just a little bit more. So this is the central normative wisdom book. This is the guidebook for wise life. It isn't simplistic, right? Even in itself, it recognizes and is aware of exceptions, but on the whole presents life in its normal operations. So interestingly, this Proverbs was one of the first books of the Bible that I ever read, and read in a way that was like, oh wow, this actually makes a lot of sense. And I've heard other guys have that experience too, where for some reason a guy will pick up the Bible and start in Proverbs and just kind of go, oh, I think God actually knows how life works. This is fascinating. Like the answers that you get for like why things happen and how to live a good and satisfying life that the world gives are just don't land. They just, if you poke at them for just a second, they just kind of fall apart. And then when you try to live kind of in worldly wisdom and it just doesn't work, and all of a sudden you turn to the book of Proverbs and you see, wow, God actually knows how the world works. That's fascinating. I wonder why. And so for me, that it was generally a starting point of like, I actually think there's something to this Bible. I was trying to read Romans at the same time. So I'd read Proverbs, I'd read Romans, and I'd go, oh, this makes sense. Then I'd read Romans, and I'd go, I have no idea what's going on. But it was helpful, right? So it was helpful. So let me just give you a quick overview of the structure. So chapters 1-9 is kind of the introduction to wisdom. Chapters 10-29 is kind of the meat of Proverbs. This is wise sayings. And then chapter 30-31 is kind of the closing bracket. Right? So it's kind of the opening and closing chapters. You're going to have longer blocks of text, some stories, some parables, some, you know, bigger strung out ideas. In the middle chunk, kind of that body, again, 10-29, pretty much every verse could more or less stand on its own. If you just kind of pulled it out, you could get a lot from any individual verse in that middle section. Now, they're not random. They're not just kind of like thrown in there. That's not a helpful way to think about it. There is some organization. There is some context. And it's a very continuous thing. Right in that middle, but kind of as a rule, if you're trying to understand any given proverb, check kind of the 10 verses before it and the 10 verses after it. They're just going to be some kind of themes you'll notice, some things that get repeated. So there'll be, you know, one thing will be said. I should give you some examples, but one thing that will be said, and then kind of you'll come back to it 4 or 5 verses later that kind of adds some depth and with some. So it's there's some context around it, but on themselves they can stand more or less as just helpful little wise sayings. Kind of a moving context would be how I would think of that. So Proverbs connects the pursuit of wisdom, and this is really interesting. I think this is what helps us know what to do with the opening bracket and the closing bracket. So Proverbs connects the pursuit of wisdom and the need to continue to pursue wisdom as you age by analogy. So wisdom, pursuit of wisdom, is connected by analogy to the pursuit of a good wife and the need to stay faithful to her as you age. So it sets up basically the pursuit of a good marriage. And the pursuit of faithfulness as you age is held up as an analogy to the pursuit of wisdom. He's holding up the pursuit of wisdom like the pursuit of a good wife. Basically, pursue wisdom while you're young, find her, and marry her. It'll be tempting to kind of mess around with folly while you're young and put off finding wisdom until you're older. Don't do that. Find wisdom young. And then, as you age, there will come seasons where folly will be tempting to you. But don't give in. Don't cheat on wisdom with folly. It'll ruin you. As you age, you'll be tempted to dabble in some folly. Don't do that. So we see this pick up, especially in chapter 4, where Solomon starts to make this case of find wisdom and hold fast to her. Hold fast to her. That's your blank. And then chapter 5, then he immediately moves into this picture, strung out instruction to cultivate your delight in the wife of your youth. Cultivate delight in the wife of your youth. Again, this is helpful advice for literal marriage, right? It's not like it's not also good wisdom for literal marriage, but it's also about how to seek to delight in wisdom even as you age, even as folly seems to be a little bit more enticing. Then chapters 6 and 7, beware the adulteress, avoid her. Again, that's good advice, but also it's about wisdom and folly. Also, it's helping you to think about wisdom and folly in very visceral terms. Chapter 9, it sets up the picture of Lady Wisdom and Madam Folly. They don't get names, but there's two women. There's Wisdom and there's Folly. And both basically inviting you to a meal. Inviting you to a meal. The one leads to life. The other leads to death. Right? So there's this picture. Personifies both Wisdom and Folly as women inviting people to come and eat with them. One leads to life. One leads to death. And then it closes with chapter 31, the portrait of a wise and godly wife. Again, this is both a good and helpful picture of a wise and godly woman, but it is also a picture of Lady Wisdom and describes the benefits of finding and clinging to wisdom as you age. It celebrates the fruitfulness of a lifetime of faithfulness to wisdom. Just notice this, Proverbs 8, verse 11, again, from that opening bracket, he says, for wisdom is better than jewels. That's your blank. Wisdom is better than jewels, and all that you may desire cannot compare with her. Then, note this in Proverbs 31, verse 10, an excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. Than jewels. So yes, that is true of a godly wife, right? It's not wisdom, not this, is both, right? But what's happening here is setting up the pursuit of wisdom in those tangible terms. Seek wisdom, marry her, don't cheat on her. That's how you live the life of righteousness, satisfaction, and dominion. All right, Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon is a picture of how to live wisely, how to fear the Lord in light of God's good gifts. In light of God's good gifts. Gifts.
Children.
Is it gifts?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. How's the volume? Are we doing all right so far? Okay. It's meant to help us to see the role of delight and gratitude in the cultivation of godly wisdom given in the face of sin and misery, even in the face of sin and misery. God's created order, including marriage, though fallen, is still good and to be delighted in. This is helpful because there's kind of a cynicism. When we look at sin and misery in the world around us, it can be tempting to us to kind of want to caveat and downplay delighting in the good things that God's given us. Delighting in the good things that God has given us. C.S. Lewis has an interesting essay in his collection of essays, Weight of Glory, where he basically talks about, he's trying to answer the question, why would you go to college during World War II? It was an interesting question. Like, London is being bombarded daily, and he's kind of asking the question, like, why would you go to college in a time like this? And he basically says, what's interesting is you're not asking the deeper question. The deeper question is, in light of the gravity of the sin and misery of the world around us that is always true in a fallen world, why would you ever spend any time studying and trying to pursue knowledge and anything like that? Right? Basically, there's a certain way that you can look at the world and say, the brokenness and the devastation of the world is so urgent and so pressing and so overbearing that nothing ever makes sense. How could you ever celebrate in a time like this? If we understand the fall, then there's a certain sense where that might make sense to just say, how can you ever celebrate when souls are being damned through death apart from Christ every day? How could you stop and celebrate? And Song of Solomon says, no. Even in a fallen and broken world, God has given us good gifts, and it is wise and godly to celebrate them. And we must. As this is a part of what Song of Solomon tells us, yes, the fall, yes, brokenness, yes, misery, and yet celebrate the good things that God has given you. Gratitude, very, very important. Okay, here's Dempster. He says, the Song of Songs, Song of Solomon, celebrates the dimensions of blessing much like Proverbs, and particularly the marital blessing. The beauty of each beloved is praised, and there is transparency to each other. There is a candid eroticism in an atmosphere of complete openness to each other, without any shame or fear. This has led some scholars to remark that the entire text is a type of commentary on Genesis 2:25. The man and the woman were naked and not ashamed. In other words, Moses says this first married couple were naked and not ashamed in basically 9 words, and Solomon says the same thing in about 2,000 words. It's a celebration of one of the blessed and good gifts of God's world. Dempster goes on, and this is probably one of his more controversial claims, but I think he's right. In the light of the larger storyline and prophetic commentary, notably Jeremiah and Hosea, the love between the two human lovers points to the relationship between the Lord and Israel at the beginning. Jeremiah 2:2, I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert, through a land not sown. Basically, he's saying the song here is both a celebration of marital intimacy, but is also a metaphor for the relationship of God and his people, or Christ and his bride, the church. So, Song of Solomon, is it Christ and the church, or is it marriage? Is this about Christ and the church, or is it simply kind of about the beauty of marriage? To some degree, if we read our Bibles kind of comprehensively, our hands are a little bit tied on this one. If we say that it's only about marriage, then what do we do with Ephesians 5:32? That says marriage is a picture of Christ and the church. So either this is kind of directly about Christ and the church, or it's about marriage, which is a picture of Christ and the church. So however you slice it, you kind of end up with both. Song of Solomon is a celebration of the blessing and oneness of marriage, which is itself a pointer to Christ's relationship to his bride, the church. So you should read it like it's about both, right? Just like Ephesians 5 itself says something about marriage and something about Christ and the church. Just because it's a picture of Christ and the church doesn't mean what it says about marriage is somehow irrelevant. It's not like when all of a sudden Paul says, what I'm saying is a mystery and it points to Christ and the church. It's not like, oh, so throw out that actual stuff about marriage. It was just a metaphor of Christ the whole time. No, it's about marriage and Christ. John Owen is someone, an older Puritan theologian, is someone who does this really, really well. In his book, Communion with God, first off, just a really good book. But second, has this really kind of good section in the middle, just expositing the Song of Solomon in light of this parallel of Christ and his church. So if you want to see how that's done, I would highly recommend John Owen's Communion with God to you. Song of Solomon verses 2-3, just to give an example, I think is a really helpful verse to kind of see all of these dimensions of what's going on there. This is the bride praising her husband and says, as an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. With great delight, I sat in his shadow, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. So what's going on there? What's going on there? This is a great verse to kind of think about how to apply Song of Solomon. So first, this is just a bride praising her husband for the great things that he provides into her life. This is a picture and a model of a woman delighting in her husband. He provides shelter for her. He gives her fruit where everybody else is just kind of a pine tree, maybe an oak tree, got some acorns. He's giving apples. This man is a provider of sustenance and goodness. So this is a picture, and it helps us to know about how should you be delighting in your husbands when he's providing these good things? Does he know that you delight in him? So, or for men, this can be a challenge to you. Are you an apple tree in the midst of a forest? Are you an apple tree? Are you providing shade and shelter? Are you bearing fruit that is good for your wife? But then we also think about Christ. Every other hope in the world ranges from desert shrubs to pine cones and acorns. But Christ alone is true refuge for us. And for his church, Christ alone provides the sweet fruit that we need to nourish us and sustain us. Okay, Lamentations. I'll do this fairly quickly. Lamentations is about how to live wisely in a good but fallen world as redeemed but still sinful people. I'll skip the Dempster quote. It'll be helpful for you to look at later on. Lamentations emphasizes that this suffering is because of Jerusalem's sins. This is not Job. Job goes out of his way to say, this is not because of Job's sin. Lamentations goes out of his way to say, this is because of Jerusalem's sin. Lamentations 1:8, Jerusalem sinned grievously, therefore she became filthy. You can read the rest. Lamentations teaches us how to continue to fear the Lord and hope in his covenant mercy in spite of our own sin. Lamentations 3:21-24, but this I call to mind. Remember, this is one who's saying, I'm guilty. This is my fault. This is just judgment on my own sin. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. New every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. Okay, so there are three errors that Lamentations should help us avoid in trying to live a wise and godly life in light of our own sin. There are three errors that Lamentations help us to avoid. First, not owning our own sin. Not owning our own sin. It's tempting to want to kind of blame shift when we see the consequences and judgment on our sin. This isn't my fault. Look at how brutal the Babylonians are being. Okay, yes, but why did God send them? Not mourning our suffering. The second one, not mourning our suffering. But if we own our sin, sometimes we just kind of don't let ourselves genuinely lament the misery and suffering of our sin. Oh, this is happening to me. This misery is falling on me because of my own sin. So who am I to complain about this? And then third, not hoping in his love. So we might mourn our sin, but kind of take his judgment as final and absolute. We give up all hope and we stop trusting in his promises. Or put positively, Lamentations helps us to own our sin, to mourn our suffering, and to hope in his covenant love. Some fun facts for you there. You can kind of read those on your own. They're all acrostics. That's interesting. So they all just kind of, or at least the first four, all work through the Hebrew alphabet. Chapter 3 has 66 verses, so three verses of each letter of the alphabet that it starts with, saying like, hey, this is the main point. This is the point. This is the point. This is the point, right? That's what that's trying to do. This chapter makes hope in the mercy of God the central theme and climax of the whole book. Chapters 1 and 2, grim, dark, silver linings of hope, but grim, dark. Chapter 3, dark, but hope is the point. So Lamentations is centered on hope in the face of our own sin. Chapter 5, I don't know what to do with this. It's an acrostic, or it's not an acrostic, but it still has 22 verses. It's like they needed a fifth chapter, but it was kind of like, I'm tired of doing acrostics. I don't know. I'll do the 22 verses, but I don't know. I don't know what to do with that. This is interesting. So quick application by way of summary. Proverbs lays out the norms for wise living. Wise living is meant to help us live righteous and satisfying lives of good and godly dominion. Song of Solomon shows us what it looks like to delight in God's good gifts, specifically marriage as the example, while also pointing us to the covenant love between God and his people. And then Lamentations helps us to live wisely in repentant hope. Repentant hope, recognizing the sin and suffering of God's creation, especially our own sin and suffering. Okay, we have a few minutes left. If you need to go pick up your kids at 11, take off. So we're not going to come back to share stuff, but take a few minutes before you leave and discuss these questions just in groups around you. Basically one discussion question for each of these proverbs. Why is it helpful to keep the distinction between norms and exceptions in mind? What errors might we fall into if we only focus on the norms? What errors might we fall into if we only focus on the exceptions? Song of Solomon, how do delight and gratitude cultivate godly wisdom? Why does a book about how to be thankful and celebrate things find a home in the book of in the collection of wisdom? How do delight and gratitude shape the way we think about God, the world, and our circumstances? And then Lamentations, how do confession, mourning, and hope cultivate godly wisdom?